Satan in the Great Tribulation. See the chart of the symbolism of the seven empires of Satan and the Antichrist on page 188. The above chart of the symbolism of the seven empires of Satan and the Antichrist is easily enough deciphered. God makes plain that one of the ways to identify Satan and the Antichrist in the future is to identify Satan's empires of the past. And John makes plain in his day that, during the Roman Empire, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. So with Moses, Daniel, Paul, and John's help, we can really get a full understanding of the nature of this beast. In Revelation 12, Satan is called the dragon, or the red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns, and seven crowns upon his heads. Revelation 12:3. Or the great dragon that was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Lucifer, and among other infamous titles, Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. Revelation 12:9. These descriptions especially apply after he is barred from heaven and is given literally free rein over the earth during the second half of the Great Tribulation. But a lot of Christians believe that Satan was thrown out of heaven a long time ago. This is a misconception we will continue to sort out. The truth is that he still regularly goes both up to heaven and down to earth, but may rarely, if ever, go to hell. I mean, I don't know of any reliable evidence that he's ever gone down there yet. His allegorical descriptions here are nearly identical to that of the Antichrists in the next chapter, except instead of a dragon, the subordinate Antichrist is designated simply as a beast. But they both symbolize, at this future time, the literal seventh world-ruling kingdom, the one John tells us is not yet come, commonly called the Antichrist kingdom or empire. And they also both emphasize, in the way they are symbolized, that this seventh kingdom originates from real cultural endowments of the previous six. And as the Antichrist appears to be only directly involved with the formation of this last kingdom, we will save most of the comparisons and discussions of him and his kingdom, including his crowns and horns, for the following subsection about him. And I mean, we will attempt as much as possible to work from this pinnacle of evil downward. But it will be necessary in this section to identify the Antichrist so we can distinguish him from, and not confuse him with, Satan. Let's start with some of the more likely misconceptions related to Satan in the middle of the Great Tribulation. When I say misconceptions, because it's error to maintain a position you cannot prove, especially if an opposing position has more scripture to support it. One popular but unproven position is that Satan will possess the Antichrist in the days of vengeance. One reason for this position, besides Satan being recently confined to the earth, is that John tells us that the dragon gave him, the Antichrist, his power and his seat and great authority. Possession could certainly accomplish this. Of course, this could just as well imply that they will remain separate entities. Another reason for this position is that the Antichrist will die right at the midpoint, obviously just before the abomination of desolation, and that he apparently will need reviving. But not to worry, his resurrection from the dead is timely. It wins him the authority to go into the temple in Jerusalem and identify himself as someone who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2:4. In other words, there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Revelation 13:5-6. And how can this character get away with all this? Is it the power of Satan in him that does it? Yes, but does Satan remain a separate entity? Whoever he really is, he brings with him the clout that comes with being the leader for the last 3.5 years of his own world-dominating kingdom, the build-up of which we will see in the next subsection. But again, the real reason he is able to pull it all off, the clincher, is revealed to us by John when he saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him, whose deadly wound was healed? Because he had the wound by a sword and did live." Revelation 13:3-14. So the reason he can pull off the abomination of desolation is that he rises from the dead as if he's Jesus Christ. No wonder. But again, is it Satan that possesses him at this point? Remembering the general rule that some erroneously count as hard and fast, that it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this the judgment, Hebrews 9:27, it is assumed by some that another spirit must reoccupy his body in order to revive him. Since Satan and his angels, some of whom are identified as princes, are in the business of possessing people, at least temporarily anyway, and since we'll see that Satan is newly available for the job, committed to the earth, if you will, it's believed by some that his availability and this once-to-die rule constrains him to occupy the Antichrist's body. But we have already found a multitude of exceptions to the once-to-die rule, which simply leaves the fact that he's available and he's a liar, so it would be like him to pull off a false resurrection like this. All things considered, I find this to be a weak case. It makes more sense to me that he will want to keep his unholy trinity intact as long as he can, because of his jealousy of God and his own pride. So I am more for the argument, and will make the case stronger as we go, that Satan will not replace the Antichrist, nor will any other replacement spirit. Instead, I believe that the Antichrist's dead body will be revived with the same spirit of the Antichrist that leaves his body, the same one he's born with. But there's also talk of this Prince of Persia, Daniel 10:20. So I should say at this point that just as people see the rapture of the church virtually everywhere in Scripture, there is an apparent rapture of souls, no matter what clues exist to identify it as a different group in time, so some see exclusively Satan or the Antichrist anywhere they see the description or allegory of an evil entity at work. Though there are obviously many other major purveyors of evil than these two, however subordinate. This Prince of Persia is one case in point. Some think he is or becomes the Antichrist because another one of the chief princes, Michael the Archangel, Daniel 10:13-20 and Jude 1:9, has a struggle with him. But in this struggle, I see no more a case for the Prince of Persia becoming the Antichrist than for the case that could be made for a number of other spiritual princes of this world taking his place, including the Prince of Grecia, or the princes of Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, or Rome. And the reason is that Chief Prince Michael's conflict with the Prince of Persia happened when the Medo-Persian Empire ruled the world and when Daniel the prophet walked the earth. That struggle was the result of the fact that the Prince of Persia was Satan's appointed subordinate spiritual ruler over that empire at that time, separate from the many human kings influenced by such spiritual princes over these empires. And Satan has surely appointed one of these spiritual princes over each of his world-ruling empires so far. Michael further indicates that the struggle with the Prince of Persia ends as the Medo-Persian Empire falls, giving rise to not only the Greek Empire, but to a new struggle influenced by the Prince of Grecia, etc. Daniel 10:20. But there's more talk of this Prince of Persia we'll get to later. For now, we should understand that there are other spiritual beings who are princes beneath Satan, himself being the supreme prince of the power of the air, Ephesians 2:2, who all have, among other duties, ruled under Satan as the real heads of each of the so-called world-ruling kingdoms. And of course, there are spiritual princes who serve under God as well, such as Michael and Gabriel. But whether serving under God or Satan, a spiritual prince, sometimes called an archangel, and their subordinate angels, operate, for the most part, from the spiritual realm. But there are obviously also human kings or princes, such as the Antichrist, the prince that shall come, Daniel 9:26, obviously operating, at least predominantly, from the physical realm. Naturally, it's important not to confuse these human and spiritual beings, as some do, because it's the spiritual ones that we really have to contend with. This, as Paul famously teaches, should not be news. He says, "We, in the physical realm, wrestle not against flesh and blood, or with ourselves, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places, including the spiritual princes in the spiritual realm." Ephesians 6:12. So this is the general rule that more likely applies when trying to decide what spirit revives the dead body of the Antichrist. Spiritual princes include Satan, the angel or king of the bottomless pit, the prince of Persia, the prince of Grecia, etc. Again, these generally do their work from the spiritual realm, which we don't see. However, I do expect more exceptions to this rule in the Great Tribulation, and especially in the days of vengeance, than are happening in this age. Some spiritual entities are fully able to manifest themselves in pretty much any form they like in the physical world, and will surely do so without restriction in the days of vengeance. These masquerades are likely to include, for example, superior alien beings from other planets, complete with spaceships and apparently superior technology. And these super-evolved spiritual ascended masters, who claim that through millions of years of evolution and or reincarnation are worthy to be our spirit guides, will convince many to believe they are here to help us out. And they may offer to protect us from other spiritual beings playing the role instead of bad guys, but nonetheless, spiritually ascended and or technologically advanced. And these false stereotypes did not arise by accident. They are part of a plan to deceive the whole world, and they are becoming more and more popular. And if these angels can do all this, why would Satan or any angel possess a limited human form, except temporarily when advantageous, when they can appear any way they like otherwise? To answer this, it would help to understand the confused difference between the relatively limited abilities of demons, such as the kind Jesus cast out, and the comparatively unlimited power of angels. And this begs a demonology study far and beyond the reach of this one. I do hope to offer additional understanding on this subject beyond what we will see in this study in the Ages of Creation study. Still, this study will give a good look at this spiritual war we're all involved in that ends at Armageddon. But for now, I can only restate our question based on realities that remain to be proven. Again, and more specifically, if Satan or any other angel can manifest in any form they like without the need of a human body, and if they can also go in and out of receptive people for the purpose of controlling them whenever they desire, then why would they permanently confine themselves in a human body for no good reason. I don't see one. It would be better for them to reside wherever they want, since they would still be fully able to manipulate a human spirit from inside or out. And it would allow them to leave when they have something better to do someplace else. And the human could mind the store for them when they're not around. This would seem to be the obvious preference, and this is the reason that it's more likely that a human spirit occupies the body of the Antichrist both before and after his resurrection, regardless of the number of visitors that could take up temporary residence any time along the way. And the Antichrist would not likely resist occasional cameo possessions within his body from time to time by any number of spiritual princes, including Satan, if circumstances warranted. Now, the spirit of the Antichrist must originally come from inside the earth, from the same place the rest of us come from, as King David explains, saying, "I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth, before being covered, or knit, in my mother's womb." Psalm 139:13-15. So when the Antichrist is born, just like you and me, he will come from the lowest parts of the earth, and this probably has already happened. But as for the Antichrist's second stay in the earth, I think that when he is revived from the dead, his spirit will likely return from a 3-day trip to the bottomless pit, also in the lower parts of the earth, where he will wait while dead until he is resurrected by Satan. And we will dig deeper into these underground topics in the section after next. So again, the general rule that I think really applies here is that there are corresponding hierarchies where the spiritual ones manipulate and run the physical ones. And I expect that the unholy trinity will remain intact throughout the death and resurrection of the Antichrist and continue lording over all. But can this general rule of the domination of the spiritual realm over the physical one be broken? It is every time a Christian prays. "Surely the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much." James 5:6. And this would be both in the physical, but especially in the spiritual realm, and contrary to the intentions of Satan and his princes. But I generally see the three persons of the unholy Trinity remaining individually distinct, and mostly unhindered in causing a hell of a lot of trouble, except by the Holy Trinity and their princes. But still there remains the question of what the human spirit of the Antichrist would be doing in the same holding tank that the angel of the bottomless pit is in. And I presume that this angel and his creatures must go back there after finishing their rampage in the fifth trumpet judgment, because I don't expect them to be able to behave themselves otherwise. This observation seems to push the argument back the other way somewhat, but not convincingly by any means. And we will debate it further in the next subsection. By the way, the sixth trumpet judgment doesn't end until after the Antichrist is already resurrected. So it appears that his spirit, if human, won't have to share the bottomless pit with the 200 million lion-headed horsemen of that judgment. They should still be on the earth while he's in the pit. And pushing back the other way, I don't see that any of the human kings of any of the past world monarchies as permanently possessed, just controlled and manipulated by their spiritual counterparts, though obviously also dealt with by God and his princes too. And I do not consider Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon to be an exception in Daniel 4. So I also expect that the human leader of the seventh and final world-ruling empire, the Antichrist, should in this respect be no different. Another observation is a general impression I get from descriptions of the Antichrist and Satan throughout Scripture. It's that everywhere I see them, and as far as I can tell, they maintain their own distinct identities, even as Jesus and the Father do. So I expect that Satan, by pride, will position himself to be like the Most High, and above everyone else, including the Antichrist, as much and as long as possible. And there is a reference from Paul that stands out for me. He speaks of the post-resurrection Antichrist, whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders. 2 Thessalonians 2:9. This indicates to me their continued distinctiveness, that Satan does supply the power, but that the Antichrist uses it, however coerced, to do the work. And the both pre- and post-resurrection events described in Revelation 12 and 13 seem to show this Father and Son as distinct individuals too. Though obviously working together, this dragon and beast are seen in these two chapters to have distinct agendas and activities, requiring them to be in different places at the same time, both before and after the resurrection. There is more to say on this subject that pertains more to the Antichrist. We will save for the next subsection. But every time these two are considered throughout the rest of this section, you should notice they always appear to be acting separately, both before and after the resurrection. My conclusion, however, is that the only thing that's wrong to say on a legitimately debatable subject is not how much you reasonably suppose, but what you preach beyond your ability to reasonably substantiate. Again, truth is best established in the totality of the Bible, and it should be tried and tested over time to make sure it stands up. That reviewed, what would Satan otherwise be doing confined on earth during the days of vengeance? I expect he will insulate himself to a comfortable extent from the surrounding physical torments by whatever conditions he may fashion in his spiritual reality. I see him, after he is cast out of heaven, as the prime power broker of the days of vengeance, whose best perspective and opportunities are managed from his own spiritual sphere of influence, and whose primary occupation is to produce, account for, and cash in on all the worship he can generate for himself, and rally this market to the extent that he makes the biggest killing of all time. And we are talking some bull market here. He gives the Antichrist his power and his seat and great authority, and everyone knows that his deadly wound was healed because the dragon gave power unto the beast. The implication here is that all that dwell upon the earth both worship the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast. Revelation 13, 2-4. Are the people that dwell upon the earth thinking here that these two become one and the same? I don't think so. I think they'll believe it's Satan's power that's behind the Antichrist, and that Satan enables him to accomplish all the natural and miraculous exploits that he will apparently perform. Of course, Satan also deceiveth the whole world to believe that his goal is not to see them all eventually destroyed. And it's Satan who gives the Antichrist power to continue 42 months, Revelation 13:5. And he gives him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, Revelation 13:6. And he gives him power to make war with the saints and to overcome them, plus power over the whole world, over all kindreds and tongues and nations, Revelation 13:7. Satan also passes power down to the false prophet, described as another beast, who exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. Revelation 13, 11 and 12. And does anyone think that Satan possesses the false prophet too? No. And this should be one of those decompartmentalizing moments for those who thought they were sure that Satan takes up permanent residence in the body of the Antichrist. However, I'm sure Satan will at least have some of his spiritual subordinates watchdogging the human Antichrist, both before and after his resurrection, as well as the human false prophet too. So power is Satan's ultimate venture investment capital for his ultimate return on investment, worship. And so much so that all the world worship the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and worship the beast. And all the world will be even more encouraged to worship Satan and the Antichrist because of the power Satan gives to the second beast, the false prophet, because he will be able to cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Revelation 13, 3 and 4, and 15. But we'll wait to take this sabbatical in the next section. The bottom line is that there are no rash investments on Satan's part, but all designed to prosper his spiritual portfolio, as we will continue to see. And I can only think that if God keeps the prayers of the saints in golden bowls and uses them literally as offerings poured out upon the golden altar, which was before the throne, Revelation 5:8 and 8, 3 and 4, then Satan can probably also derive some spiritually powerful use of his worship that translates somehow into the physical world, and enough of it that he will deceive even himself to believe that he can gain the whole world. But this hope of Satan's must all come tumbling down after a war in heaven that he loses, so that when he arrives on earth, he will certainly be in a fighting mood and will be all about gaining reinforcements and all the most effective weapons he can get his hands on to make his last stand. And I expect that his primary weapon will be worship. And when Satan is cast out of heaven, he will be free like never before to fight fang and claw for the worship he will get in the days of vengeance. Surely he will deploy his forces with a supernatural strategy beyond human comprehension. And he will be strictly business. There will be a bona fide worldwide run on the market, that is, for those unwittingly in the market for lakefront property in hell. Isaiah puts it this way: therefore hell hath enlarged herself, and opened her mouth without measure, and their glory, and their multitude, and their pomp, and he that rejoiceth shall descend into it. Isaiah 5:14. And a warning from Jesus is appropriate for this hell-bent multitude. He warns, "For what is a man advantaged if he gain the whole world and lose himself or be cast away?" Matthew 16:26, Mark 8:36 and 37, and Luke 9:25. But Satan will knowingly pay this price to gain the whole world, and will deceive all the world into following him. To those who follow him, Jesus says, "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father will ye do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there was no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar, and the father of it." John 8:44. And speaking of the father of all liars brings to mind the first and biggest father of all lies. This is the infamous lie that he told Eve, that "ye shall be as gods," Genesis 3:5. This is his principal lie, which he still continues to employ extremely persuasively. And he will convince all the world to suffer what must be otherwise unthinkable for the hope that they will ultimately become as gods on the other side of it all. And it's not necessary that he's lying about resurrecting the Antichrist, because he fathers plenty of other doozies. For example, one way or another, and obviously allowed by God, he will enable this beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit to kill the two witnesses. In the process, he will obviously misrepresent them, as well as the 144,000 Jews, as heretical and evil, using them as notorious focal points for the rising widespread anti-Semitism that will be even more eagerly supported by those who already hate the Jews in the first place. He will also repeatedly take undeserved credit for getting rid of Christians and Jews throughout the Great Tribulation, including at the rapture of the church, and of the 144,000 Jews. And even, I suspect, for getting rid of the large number of not yet disposed of dead bodies, which disappear in the rapture of the Tribulation Gentiles and Tribulation Jews. Certainly all the world will be deceived to believe that those disappearing or being executed are the ones that are too fundamental or unevolved, read Protestant or Jewish, to be ready for what will be mistaken as a pilgrimage of ascent to godhood. Because of these and other lies, survivors, as long as they survive, will jump through any hoop as trained dogs, believing that those who die, but especially that those who disappear, are being purged, not redeemed, and for the good of all. Accidental or otherwise, deaths of non-Protestant or non-Jewish people, including the ones whose bodies don't disappear, will be thought to be souls that need another turn around the karmic wheel, where they will be born again to try again, or thought to be serving time for their sins in purgatory, or some such other ultimately redeeming process based on one false religion or another, which includes the theory of evolution. But whether dead or alive, those raptured will necessarily be thought of differently, though theories about them will undoubtedly come from a variety of sources too. Those more scientifically minded will likely view those who disappear as those who couldn't make the cut in the next evolutionary step of punctuated equilibrium, where punctuated means a quick evolutionary change, in this case evidenced by the disappearance of the unevolved and the gloating of the survivors, followed by equilibrium, or the new higher evolved level of stability of the species, in this case a presumed step toward godhood. And don't laugh. This is real evolutionary science, thought up, well, really stolen, and popularized by a well-respected Harvard professor, who is now likely tormented in hell, unless he was converted on his deathbed. I'll talk more about him and his usurped theory in the Ages of Creation study. The point for now is that those left behind on the earth with this perspective will flatter themselves to believe they have experienced a sudden step up in evolution, and that they have experienced a spontaneous change of species from man to God, while those who disappear will be believed to have not been sufficiently fit to survive. And just as it's said that the reason dinosaurs disappear in the fossil record is because they could not adapt to survive, so it will be said of those who disappear in the Great Tribulation. Another more recent and related so-called scientific theory, also likely to be used to explain this phenomenon, would be rapid evolutionary diversification, where it's now admitted, at least in some high school textbooks, that there was a sudden explosive diversification of higher evolved life in the lowest level of the geological column. The Creation Science magazine, Impact, offers an explanation of this new theory, reporting, "This sudden appearance in the geological record of most of the major animal groups is exactly contrary to what Darwin predicts, namely the Tree of Life." Impact, August 2005, page 5. And this Cambrian explosion of fossils in the lowest level of the fossil record will surely be offered as evidence of a precursor to man's leap to godhood. And stop laughing. This is serious science. however falsely so-called. 1 Timothy 6:20. And by the way, some creation scientists argue that science, in this scripture, really means philosophy, and that it doesn't therefore apply to science. Excuse me, but in the case of evolutionary science, what's the significant difference between calling it a false science and a false philosophy? And for a lot more along these lines, see the Ages of Creation study. Then there are those inclined to think more outside the box, who will prefer to think that higher life forms are running the show. They will be deceived to think that the angels who take the form of, read masquerade as, superior aliens and land in real spaceships are really super-evolved extraterrestrial life forms. And these angels have been practicing this kind of masquerade for some time now. But in the Great Tribulation, I'm expecting that such extraterrestrial activity will pick up quite a bit. And many such like-minded, who are rooting for the creation of a United Federation of Planets, especially the millions of sci-fi junkies who listen to the likes of Art Bell, George Norrie, and Whitley Strieber, etc., will naturally think that raptures are mass abductions by superior alien beings to keep inferior life forms from ruining the world for the rest. But others will expect a War of the Worlds and fear such things as the harvesting of DNA by aliens to bolster and repair their failing gene pool. Yeah, these are more prime topics for the Ages of Creation study too. And by the way, I've been tuning into Coast to Coast AM broadcasts since 1991. It's one of the ways I watch the end coming. And still there's the largest group, the more religious-minded, who will simply give all the credit to Satan through the Antichrist. They'll think the disappeared have been removed to some oblivion or another, and also that this father and son can resist or pacify any alien force, and that they are even ascended above natural law. And I imagine that Satan will ultimately provide some kind of unifying explanation that will somehow consolidate his power and authority. But whatever one's perspective, it will surely be thought by all those deceived by Satan that those who disappear do so for the good of the world. And survivors will soldier on, encouraged by Satan's lies, that those who persevere will ultimately become as gods. And by this means, Satan will succeed in condemning to eternal damnation, generally speaking, all the world. And remember that Paul confirms that the world's fate involves cooperation with Satan and the Antichrist. Specifically, he says this cooperation is with the Antichrist, whose coming, including his resurrection, is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness and them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. 2 Thessalonians 2:9 and 10. More plainly, the people of the world share the blame that they perish because of their own deceivableness of unrighteousness in them, and because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. It's a cooperation of guilt, where apparently the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not. 2 Corinthians 4:4. Because they allow him to. And I guess it shouldn't be too hard to understand that unrighteous people who are not really interested in the truth are easily enough deceived by Satan, especially since God supports it all by sending strong delusion. 2 Thessalonians 2:11. But I'm also guessing that there should be some new Christians on earth at this time. And there should even be more resaved former backsliders, the ones that are left behind and immediately get what's going on. and surely any that find and keep an unshakable faith will not be part of them that perish. And they will be immune to this delusion and deception. And this is that great gulf between the deceived and any particular new babe in Christ. So we have considered to some extent the power of the working of Satan. He raises the Antichrist from the dead and empowers the Antichrist and the false prophet to do their working. And we have seen some of his lies and how he will spin the truth to take credit and exalt himself simply by misrepresentation and by taking credit for God's power on display. But Satan must exhibit his own signs and lying wonders beyond resurrecting the Antichrist. And Satan's signs are certainly different than God's that Jesus outlines on the Mount of Olives. At the end of Jesus' list of God's judgments, in the beginning of sorrows, he speaks of great signs from heaven, Luke 21:11. And we will attempt to explain these further in section 9. But I will not attempt to peer through the dark glass into the spiritual world to attempt to discern Satan's activities in that realm any further here. What we can examine more clearly, though, are the signs he administers through the Antichrist and the false prophet. So what are signs and lying wonders? Plainly enough, they are real miracles, no sleight of hand would do, performed with the power of Satan by the Antichrist and the false prophet, or by any of their ministers, that lead those who witness them or hear them to believe lies. As such, and as far as I can tell, it might be difficult to distinguish signs from lying wonders. Their definitions, in many cases, may be interchangeable. For example, the resurrection of the Antichrist would seem to qualify for either, even without a change of identities in the process, because either way, it could mislead Jews and new Christians to believe that the Antichrist is the real Messiah. But being dead and then resurrected on the third day is certainly one of the more classic signs. So says even Jesus. The killing of the two witnesses also seems to qualify for either because it will take supernatural power to accomplish it and be sold to the world as a miraculous emancipation from a scourge of evil, but also as a big sign that the world is, as a result, blessed with the right leader for the job, and also the right God of this world. From observations like these, we could conclude that the difference is that signs help establish a new lie, while lying wonders simply help to perpetuate existing ones, so that all new signs by the power of Satan are also lying wonders, but not all lying wonders are necessarily new signs. But it's not safe to limit these terms to just this definition, because I expect that just when you think you have Satan's devices figured out is when he will be able to deceive you by other unexpected uses of them. And I expect that there is no limit to his ability to deceive us. And more than anything else, I expect nothing from Satan but foul play in this regard, and to be continually shocked and appalled at how far and unfairly he is willing to cheat trying to win this game. Talk about being a bad sport. Satan's use of all power and signs and lying wonders will become the new standard of really fighting dirty. And only some of the few will get it. And what I mean by some of the few is that, according to Jesus, only a few will find salvation altogether. So at the middle of the Great Tribulation, when Satan has empowered the Antichrist and false prophet, and they're performing all kinds of signs and lying wonders, and when those taken in the rapture of the church are already gone, and when a lot of the resaved former backsliders are already gone in the rapture of the tribulation Gentiles, only a fraction of the few will be left to redeem. I also mean that these signs and lying wonders are miracles, true supernatural events that people will naturally believe point to the truth. Therein lies the treachery of the power of Satan. He can make any fantasy materialize as real to the touch. So who has a chance against an enemy like this? And who could resist such power? That would be the one who stood at the door of your heart, knocking until you finally let him in. Thank God. Anyway, I don't expect we'll even scratch the surface of revealing all the power and signs and lying wonders used in this ambush of humanity known as the Great Tribulation, where only some of the few can be saved, and God will otherwise make a man more precious than fine gold. But to give you an idea anyway, I have been reading Discover, a science digest, cover to cover for the last few years. It's one of the ways I watch the end coming. In October 2008, they build their issue around the theme, Reinventing the World, subtitled, A Better Future is Waiting, We Just Have to Make It Happen. The collection of articles is mostly about our energy future, but along the way they report on cutting-edge science going on right now that should shortly lead to Star Trek-style replicator devices and other technologies that can manufacture matter in many forms on demand, both inorganic and organic, including applications for teleportation. My point is that if humans are that close to being able to do what angels can do, then imagine how incredible but believable the manifested power of Satan will be. And by the way, the military applications are potentially horrifying. So is just about every other possible application. But like the Tower of Babel, this implies that it can't be that much longer before God will have to intercede before things get out of control. Though I think he will wait until things get a lot more out of control than they are now. And that from this perspective, we can see that there's still some time left. Of course, signs and lying wonders have always been the basis for the existence and propagation of many false religions. And they have always been connected to their origins or major transformations throughout the ages. The only difference in the Great Tribulation, and especially in the Days of Vengeance, is that the rulers of the darkness of this world and the spiritual wickedness in high places, Ephesians 6:12, all led by Satan, will be allowed by God to step things up like never before. In this present age, we see occasional key disciples being supernaturally misled to advance one particular false religion or another, with the opportunity for slow, steady enlistment over much more available time. Such false religions also grow with the occasional help from real healings that hoodwink followers here, or a life-threatening curse that bamboozles conformity there, or possessions with or without the subsequent exorcisms here and there, and other sparsely scattered miracles that deceive. But in the days of vengeance, I expect these kinds of lying wonders will become much more powerful, widespread, and common in order to most effectively deceive all the world rather quickly. And you should now be noticing many ways that the world is already being prepared to accept such signs and lying wonders. But besides other reasons we'll get to in due course, I think we need another generation or two to pass before the rapture will be ready to take place. A big reason is that too many people now alive would think, oh my God, I missed the rapture. And I'm guessing that this still too popular awareness needs to diminish another generation or so. And Satan must still need more time to prepare the false religious system that he'll need to use in the Great Tribulation. And Scripture will identify this institution for us as we go. But we should expect from the start that there will be much less competition among false religions in the Great Tribulation, but especially in the Days of Vengeance, because then Satan and the Antichrist worship will reign supreme, whichever system winds up getting the job of supporting him through the false prophet. And chapter 11 of the book of Daniel, which we'll break down in the next subsection, and Revelation 17 and 18, which we'll handle some in this section but more in the next, make clear that Satan still has some division in his ranks to deal with, and that this will be the case throughout the days of vengeance. And God's omnipotent and miraculous power must show a major resurgence, because without the Spirit in play, it will be the world-renowned, awesome, earth-shaking, destructive, and supremely respect-building spectacles of God that will help bring this fraction of the few to the saving knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ in the Great Tribulation. And as we go, we'll improve our perspective of these incredible displays of God's power. But surely all of God's displays of power, not to mention some of Satan's, will be used to deceive the world and convince them that these spectacular displays are the work of the forces of evil, unless Satan and the Antichrist can spin them to take credit for them themselves. But let's not forget to give credit where credit is due. Satan will not only be able to accomplish all that he accomplishes because God creates, empowers, and lets him, but also because God makes him and all the world do what they do. God is the cause that the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, that really, by God's empowering, deceiveth the whole world, and not without the help of Satan's angels who were cast out with him. Revelation 12:9. So without question, it's God who forces Satan and his angels to be contained on the earth and instigates the following: woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is forcibly come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time, given to him by God. Revelation 12:12. And remember that more startling than this, God will send something that will be the cause of many to be lost. The problem is that the inhabitants of the earth, as Paul explains, will not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. 2 Thessalonians 2:10-12. So God sends both Satan and strong delusion so that the inhabitants of the earth will want to believe his lies. And I'm expecting there will be some whoppers beyond what can possibly be fully predetermined by any study. Still, some of these fish stories, such as punctuated equilibrium evolution or superior alien mass abduction, we'll be able to reel in and land in the ages of creation study. By the way, I said there are 9 recorded raptures for the Great Tribulation, but you could just as easily say there are 10, and if you count the harvest at the end of the millennium, 11, and since this post-millennial rapture is really a split harvest, you could also say there are 12. But this 10th one, actually occurring probably fourth, lacks one qualification that the others have. It doesn't involve a group. It's just of one person, the Antichrist. This rapture, or resurrection, which I also consider a rapture, also leads to no possibility of redemption, but so do other raptures in these 12, including one that is technically neither for redemption or damnation in and of itself. So when I speak of only 9 raptures, I mean there are 9 recorded group raptures in and around the Great Tribulation, 10 if you count the solo, and 12 if you add and itemize the postmillennial rapture. And these are just the raptures of record. Like Philip, Acts 8:39, I guess there could be others that aren't pre-recorded. In the next subsection, you can count on learning things about the Antichrist and his kingdom you've never heard before. This is because, among other reasons, that a certain prophecy that was closed up and sealed to the time of the end is no longer. And I mean that it's my understanding that only part of the prophecy in Daniel 10 through 12 has been open until now. And this should mean that the time of the end could not have fully come until now. Indeed, we will confirm that the whole prophecy, all of Daniel 10 through 12, must be fully opened before the time of the end can be considered fully here. And I know God finished opening it for me on May 6th, 2007. So prepare to see that we can now prove that the time of the end has now finally and just fully come. So help me God, and so God has helped me.